On episode 363 of the 40 Plus Fitness podcast, we meet Jonathan Baylor and discuss his book, The Set Point Diet, the 21-day program to permanently change what your body wants to weigh. You can find the full show notes for this episode at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/363. Have you decided you're ready to make a change? To reclaim your health and fitness? The 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is here for you. I'm your host, Alan Meisner. I'm an NSAM certified personal trainer with a specialization in corrective exercise and fitness nutrition. Let me be your coach as you find your way on your health and fitness journey. All right, let's go. Often when we're trying to lose weight, we end up getting into a stall or a plateau. Well, our guest today in his book, The Set Point Diet, is going to tell you why that happens and what you can do to break the cycle. He is the New York Times bestselling author of The Calorie Myth, and I'm pretty certain The Set Point Diet is also going to make that bestseller list. With no further ado, here's Jonathan Baylor. Jonathan, welcome to 40 Plus Fitness.
Thank you so much for having me.
When I was really getting deep into my self-education of what I needed to do for myself, I came across The Calorie Myth. And it was an eye-opening book, to say the least, for someone who really had been brought up in the mantra of calories in, calories out, just eat less, exercise more. And I'd be like, well, I get on the treadmill or I get on the elliptical and I work my butt off and then I'm starving all day. And then I need to eat more calories. And they're like, well, okay, eat your calories back. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm eating at a deficit and I've done this for a while and it's not working. And I think a lot of people run into that fact of they're doing everything right and their body just doesn't want to get rid of the weight.
It can be extremely frustrating, Alan. And it gets to the root of my whole team's work. And, you know, really we stand on the shoulders of giants, just articulating research done by the top doctors at the Harvard Medical School, Johns Hopkins, UCLA, the Cleveland Clinic, the Mayo Clinic, over the past 60 years, that's just been buried from the mainstream. And that this definition of you're doing everything right, what we've found is just the definition of what is right is wrong. It's analogous to when we look at obesity and diabetes as diseases, which they are, as classified by the American Medical Association. That if you were to go to a doctor with a broken arm and the doctor were to prescribe you cough syrup and you took that cough syrup correctly, chances are your arm wouldn't get any better and you would feel very helpless. It's a condition called learned helplessness because you're doing everything you're told, but the treatment for the disease you're suffering from or the medical condition you're suffering from is simply incorrect. And that's what we found over the past now 15 years, that this prescription that we've been written for both obesity, overweight, and diabetes is simply wrong. What we have been told is right is wrong, and that is evidenced by the catastrophic impact it's had on our culture.
Yes, and I do have to say this also. In your book, The Set Point Diet, I mean, you just really got deep into the science of, you know, each point you had in there was supported. And I really, really liked that. It was so much support. You couldn't put all the bibliography in the book. You have to link to another website to say, if you really want to go down the rabbit hole, I did. I spent a lot of time in that rabbit hole because it was just really fascinating stuff. Our body has this set point. And I talk to my clients about it all the time as they plateau and they're working hard. They're doing some of the right things or most of the right things, but their body's going to somewhat hit this set point. You call it a set point. I call it the body's happy weight. We might not be happy with it, but our body is. Can you talk a little bit in detail about the set point and why we have a set point?
Alan, the term set point for a lot of your listeners may say, you know, I've heard of that term before. And there is a bit of an irony here. In 1983, there was a book published called The Set Point Diet, literally the exact same title of my book, but you can't copyright a title. So, and that was also the year I was born. So I don't know, you know, fate had the, you know, destiny in store for me, but the concept of set point has been around for a while. But the thing that's happened over the past 7 to 10 years, which has been so revolutionary, is it's gone from the set point theory to we've now proven this. And I say we, I mean just the broader scientific community, not me personally. Because, for instance, if you look at just even Wikipedia and you look up diabetes, the medical condition diabetes is defined by the breakdown in the body's ability. This is according to Wikipedia. I'm not saying that Wikipedia is like God's truth. I'm just saying that even Wikipedia is acknowledging this, says that diabetes is the breakdown of the body's ability to homeostatically, aka automatically, regulate blood sugar around a healthy range, right? That's you do things to raise your blood sugar, your body does things to lower it, you do things to lower your blood sugar, your body automatically does things to elevate it. So there's never been a question ever that there is a set point around your blood sugar. There's also never been a question ever that there is a set point for blood pressure, right? The breakdown in that homeostatic regulation of blood pressure is called hypertension. The breakdown in the homeostatic regulation of blood sugar is called diabetes. And we've now proven over the past 7 to 10 years that the breakdown in the body weight set point, which is as irrefutable as the blood pressure and blood sugar set points, is known as the disease of obesity or overweight, period. And it's no more debatable than that your body regulates body temperature, blood pressure, blood sugar. And once you understand that, it changes everything about how we approach weight gain and weight loss.
Right. Because if we don't reset our set point, then basically we are not going to be able to, in the long term, keep that weight off.
That's exactly right. And it would be just as absurd. And this is such, like, once someone gets the following point, it's a little bit like seeing life in color for the first time. It will just change the way you see everything. So if you went to your doctor and you had diabetes and your doctor said, "Okay, eat less," you would wait, what? Like, that's obviously not, like, eating less does not fix the problem with your pancreas, the problem with insulin secretion, the underlying root of the breakdown of the blood sugar set point can't be solved by starvation. If you went to your doctor with suffering from hypertension, again, the breakdown in the blood pressure set point, and your doctor said, "Eat less, you lazy glutton," we would say, wait a minute, that's not, there's something else happening. It's the same thing with body weight.
Right. Now, there are, in the book, you mentioned three hidden factors that are basically setting this set point. So if I want to fix my set point, these are the three areas I need to think about, right?
Exactly. There's the term, again, set point has been around for quite a bit of time, but what has changed recently is a concrete definition and identification of what makes it up, how it breaks down, and how we can fix it. So what determines your body weight or body fat set point is the interaction of three key elements of your biology and physiology: your brain, your gut, and your hormones. And very specifically, when there is inflammation in your brain, when there is dysregulation in your gut microbiota, and when you have hormonal imbalances, the ability of those, you know, your first brain and your second brain, your gut, to communicate via hormonal signals to automatically regulate appetite, to automatically burn calories. It's not that calories don't exist, and it's not that calories in, calories out is like unicorns. It's that is, your body is brilliantly set up to automatically regulate calories in and calories out so that you maintain this body weight set point. But when that system, the brain, the gut, and the hormones breaks down, that set point creeps up and obesity ensues.
Yeah. And I kind of equated of, you know, when people say the calories in, calories out, or they want to keep that paradigm, they just want to keep sticking to that simple rule. I say, well, there are periods of time when our ancestors had no food, and there were times when the food was abundant. And I'm guessing that our bodies probably weren't designed to just allow them to get obese over the summer and then whittle away over the winter. There's some metabolic changes that are happening during those periods of time that are allowing them to continue to survive.
That is correct. And the thing that is essential to understand is that at the most basic level, the only thing that we need to prove from a scientific perspective to say that the set point is an irrefutable fact is if you feed people more calories than they need, does their body automatically burn more calories? The answer is yes. If you feed people fewer calories than they need, does their body automatically burn fewer calories? The answer is yes. And you can even look at it from a different perspective. You could say if someone exercises very heavily earlier in the day, does their body work to conserve calories later in the day? The answer is yes. So I mean, we've all experienced that. You have a really tough workout. How do you feel for the rest of the day? Tired. So that's your body automatically working to balance calories. And then as a consequence, your weight, as calories are a component of that, not the be-all, end-all. They are a component automatically.
Yeah. Well, I'd say tired and very hungry.
Exactly.
Now, I want to deep dive a little bit into each of those three factors because I think there's a lot of value in understanding how each of those affects our set point. Can we start with the brain inflammation and work through the three and just kind of talk about how that really impacts the set point?
Inflammation in your brain, or very specifically areas around your lateral and ventromedial hypothalamus, we take a step back. There's a couple parts of your brain. The one that is relevant for our conversation here is called your hypothalamus. And your hypothalamus is the part of your brain that has to do with allowing mission critical functions that must take place 24/7, 365 without conscious control to happen. So for instance, if you had to consciously think about regulating breaths in and breaths out, you could not function as a human being. We could not function as a species if our conscious brain, our neocortex, had to worry about beating our heart or blinking our eyes or shivering when we got cold or prompting the sensation of needing to use the restroom when we consumed excess liquid. So there's a part of your brain that is 100% dedicated to taking care of those life-sustaining, constant, mission-critical functions. That's called your hypothalamus. When inflammation exists in the hypothalamus, those signals of you need to use the restroom, or you need to breathe, or you need to slow down or speed up can become compromised. And we know this just irrefutable facts that there are certain substances completely independent of calories, take MSG for example, that has a detrimental impact on the hypothalamus, causing inflammation in the hypothalamus. And there are foods such as certain omega-3 fatty acids, which reverse inflammation in the hypothalamus. So if we're having a conversation about weight and we are not discussing inflammation in the brain and we are not discussing the hypothalamus, we are essentially having a at best incomplete and at worst counterproductive discussion about weight.
Okay. Now, foods and things that are going to help us with this brain inflammation, like you mentioned omega-3, so I'm assuming fish oil going to help us. Processed foods are going to hurt us.
Yes. So when it comes to brain, gut, and hormones, the good news is it's not, you don't, As fate would have it, not dying is relatively simple. Because if it was extremely complicated, we probably would not have survived and thrived as a species as well as we have. So the way that we need to eat to optimize the health of our brain and our gut and our hormones is the same, which is important because I don't want you to have to memorize, yeah, I have to eat these foods for my brain, yeah, and then I need to set aside this part of my plate for my hormones, yeah, and this part of my brain plate for my gut. So we can cover what to eat all at once if you'd like, or I can talk about it now.
Yeah, because we're gonna get into the same model in a bit. So we'll get into that then. But okay, cool. So let's step into the microbiota.
One of the most shocking things when I just talk with people about this casually is understanding that about 90% of the cells that exist in what you call you are not yours. They're cells of microorganisms that live in or on you. This is like the the human being, that which we define as a human being, is actually trillions of little beings put together. And that is, we're learning more and more about that. The mainstream is talking more and more about that. But when you look specifically at body weight, the research is so clear that there are certain types of bacteria which are much more prevalent in the gut of individuals who struggle with overweight than there are in individuals who are naturally thin. And we can even go so far as to say there are certain types of microbiota that crave, like these little creatures crave different foods. So while you think you might have a craving for sugary and starchy foods, it is literally true that you don't, but rather these microorganisms that are living in your gut do. So if you want to enlist billions of little bacterial helpers to help maintain a healthy weight and to crave, to literally crave the same foods that facilitate that, you can. And you're not an army of one, you're an army of trillions working towards this lower set point, this sane lifestyle, and really feeling great and craving the foods that help you to feel that way.
Cool. And then the final piece is the hormones.
Hormones talked about ad nauseum, but still not given enough attention, because there, we can't talk too much about hormones, because when you go to a gym and when you look on the television screens and when you look at the ads, it's not going to say things like, hey, do this exercise because of its hormonal impact. It's going to say, do this exercise because you burn this many calories. And at the end of the day, your body does what hormones tell it to do, period. This is so important to understand, because let's use a simple example that most people are familiar with, anabolic steroids. Why do anabolic steroids work? Anabolic steroids work because they are essentially a hormonal messenger that tells your body, build muscle. So therefore, your body builds muscle. So we know testosterone communicates X and your body does X. Estrogen communicates Y and your body does Y. And we know that. So if we are talking about eating and exercise, if we are talking about weight loss, without talking about the hormonal impact of what we're eating or the hormonal impact of how we're moving, again, we're just missing. It's a little bit like, I'm just going to try to think of an analogy on my feet here, but if you went to the eye doctor and the eye doctor was like, well, let's talk about, you know, how your feet are doing. You're like, doc, I can't see. And we're not even talking about my eyes. We're talking about my feet. Like, what? If you are not having a conversation about hormones while you are discussing your weight and your overall health, it's a little bit like going to the eye doctor and have a conversation about your feet, because your body does, period, what your hormones tell it to do. So if you don't know, and if you haven't been empowered with the information you need to control that conversation and to get your body saying what you want it to say, aka burn fat and help me feel energetic, but rather you have hormones getting triggered that are saying store fat and make me feel tired, it doesn't matter how little you eat or how much you exercise, that conversation will probably only go worse and make the problem worse.
Yeah, I was going through the hormone section of the book and going through each of them. I was like, there were some that came up that I was like, you know, we don't talk about these much at all. We talk about insulin. We talk about leptin and ghrelin. We talked about testosterone, cortisol, but after that, there's some of these other ones like CCK and apodectin and glucagon. There's a lot of them, and it's in my mind as I'm getting into it. I know what most of these do fairly well, and I know how to balance and manage a few of them. But I think the cool part of all of this was that your SANE method, it actually addresses all of them.
I appreciate you saying that, Alan, because that is the key thing here. Because, you know, the thing that I really don't like is when people are made to believe that their bodies are fundamentally broken or stupid. And unless they micromanage these mission critical biological functions, that they are doomed to a state of obesity and disease. I think that is a diabolical way of looking at the human body, that unless we intervene and micromanage that our bodies are destined to be fat, diseased, diabetic, cancerous wastelands, which when you think about it is really what a lot of the fitness and diet industry says. Like, unless you know what every single hormone is doing at every single point in time and what your calorie count is and exactly how many steps you've taken and things are going to go off the rails and you're going to be in bad shape, which is cannot be true. Why? Before we had any of the problems we had today, nobody did those things and everyone was healthier. So by definition, it cannot be required to micromanage every aspect of your input and output in order to achieve effortless health, as evidenced by the fact that radically more people enjoyed effortless health in the past than the present. I'm not talking about hunter-gatherers. I'm talking about like in the 50s or in the 60s when no one went to a gym, no one was focused on calories, and everyone was just healthier. So what's beautiful is, you know, we can read the set point diet. I would appreciate if people read the set point diet. I think they will live radically better if they read the set point diet. But even if you remember no names of any hormones, if you simply remember eat sane foods in such high quantities that you're too full for insane foods, all the brain stuff, all the hormone stuff, all the gut stuff will take care of itself and you will live radically better.
And that's one of the messages that came out of the book that I was just really happy to see is, up until maybe about a year or two ago, diabetes was a progressive disease. You're going to die. You're going to lose feet. You're going to lose your kidneys. You're going to everything. And now we're saying, no, if you make lifestyle changes, you can reverse your diabetes. And the other thing was, obesity. Well, you've got some genetic problems, and so we can work out and we can cut some of the weight, but you're always going to be big boned and overweight. And now we're finding, no, if you make substantive lifestyle changes, we can reverse obesity. You talked about the sane foods, and I definitely want to get into that. What are the sane foods so we can stay away from the insane foods?
We came up with that's actually a bad way of describing it. It was more as if the universe presented this acronym SANE to me while I was doing this 15-year research journey. Because I stumbled upon, I was doing all this research, and I said, it seems like there are these things that they're not commonly discussed and they're not in any way, shape, or form controversial in the scientific community. These are things like how much foods fill you up and how long they keep you full. And there's studies been done for decades on, let's feed people 1,200 calories of this type of diet and feed people 1,200 calories of this type of diet and see which keeps people fuller longer. That existed, and that's called satiety. And then the research around the different impact on hormones that foods have. This is sometimes discussed in popular literature as glycemic index or glycemic load, but it's much broader than just insulin or just some of these sexy hormones that are discussed. And so the way I define that is, I just said aggression, because it looked like it was very clear in the research that there are some foods and just some lifestyle decisions in general that cause these wild, aggressive swings in your hormones. And you can imagine that's not great. And then the nutrient density, right? This is something that's extremely important, is talked about a lot, but unfortunately is not talked about in the most optimum way, which is the ratio of essential nutrients, vitamins, minerals, amino acids, fatty acids, to things that are non-essential and or toxic, like sugar. So someone looks at the cereal aisle, they see Honey Nut Cheerios, and it says it's healthy because it's enriched with vitamins and minerals. But if you put a vitamin pill in a can of Pepsi, I don't think anyone would say that that can of Pepsi has now become healthy. So it's essential that we look at
the
ratio.
Please don't tell PepsiCo about that vitamin. they will do it.
They might do it. They might do it. So we got to take a different look at nutrition. And then there's also different macronutrients are processed differently by the body, more or less efficiently stored as fat. So it, as the universe would have it, we have satiety, aggression, nutrition, and efficiency. And that happens to spell out the acronym SANE. And what's really cool is that all four of those factors can be objectively measured. You don't have to take anyone's word for it. It's not my opinion. It's not any researcher's opinion. There's a scientific method to measure them. So we can look at any food and say, how satisfying, aggressive, nutritious, and efficient is it? And then we can say, these are sane foods. These are insane foods. And to the extent that you choose to eat sane foods, you will live extremely well. And to the extent that you choose to eat insane foods, you will not live as well. and we can empower people with that information.
Now, you laid out several of the sane foods and several of the insane foods. I don't want to go through an exhaustive list, but there was one that came up, and your approach to it was very, very different than anyone else. You're not a big fan of olive oil.
There are three characteristics that, so just to, I don't want to, you know, I can't give away the farm on this show by definition because it's a long book, but I'll give away some of the farm here, which is sane foods fall into four categories: non-starchy vegetables, nutrient-dense protein, whole food fats, and low fructose fruits, in that order. And one of the biggest, coolest new things about the new book is we actually subdivide those into optimal groups. So these are the optimal non-starchy veggies, optimal nutrient-dense proteins. These are the things that are most therapeutic to lower your set point. The common characteristic amongst sane foods and amongst all those food groups are the presence of three things: water, fiber, and protein. Which is, again, beautiful. It's like, hey, you know, this all becomes very simple. Basically, foods that are high in water, fiber, and protein are saner than foods that are lower in water, fiber, and protein. And if you look at vegetables, right, vegetables, non-starchy vegetables are very high in water, fiber, protein. That's why if you put spinach in a blender, it blends, it becomes a liquid. Whereas if you put crackers in a blender and blend them, it becomes a powder. Because crackers don't have liquid in them. Spinach is primarily all liquid. It just doesn't look that way. It's also shockingly high in protein. We all know that vegetables have a lot of fiber. Anyway, if we look at fat, we have been told a lot about, first of all, fat doesn't make you fat, which is 100% true. And then we've also heard a lot about olive oil, just like slather your food in olive oil, and it's fantastic to use olive oil. Without question, olives contain more water, fiber, and protein than olive oil. So the point that I make in the book, and the point that I would just encourage people to think about, and the point that people in the sane community have found to be so transformational for them in breaking through plateaus and in living well, is, look, if coconut oil is good for you, which it is relative to other oils, if olive oil is good for you, which it is relative to other oils, you know what's even better for you? Coconut. You know what's even better for you? Olives. We call these whole food fats because they have more nutrients. They have more water. They have more fiber. They have more protein. So one could say that I am not anti-olive oil. I'm pro complete scientific information. So if one were to say that olive oil is a healthy oil and olive oil is a sane oil, I would 100% agree with that statement. Now, if someone said, I think you should get 600 calories per day from olive oil because fat is good for you, I would say if you got 600 calories per day from whole food fats because fat is good for you, you would live radically better than if those 600 calories came from a low water, low fiber, and low protein fat source such as olive oil.
Absolutely. Now you kind of did a spin on the My Plate and you call it the same plate. Could you take some time, because you've already laid out the elements of what we should be looking for as far as fiber, water, and protein, but you've actually laid this out now on a plate. So we know how much of the starchy, non-starchy vegetables, how much of the protein, and how much of the low fructose fruit we should have on the plate. Can you kind of talk about what that percentage is and what that looks like?
Really important to think in terms of a plate, because I don't know anybody, myself included, who goes to a restaurant or to a dinner table or to the grocery store and says, where can I find the fiber? Or what is the protein that we're going to eat right now? Or I want some water on my plate. Like, it doesn't make any sense, right? Those are scientific terms that don't really help us at the dinner table. So when we sit down at the dinner table or at a restaurant, what should our plate look like? It's extremely simple. Half your plate should be non-starchy vegetables. And non-starchy vegetables are vegetables that you could, but you don't have to, eat raw. And this is just a really important distinction, because a lot of people have been told that things like corn and potatoes are vegetables. They're not. They can't be eaten raw. They are starches. Vegetables, non-starchy vegetables, are plants, which are generally quite colorful with a few exceptions, which could be eaten raw. Think any green leafy vegetable. Think things like peppers, mushrooms, cucumbers, zucchinis, broccoli, asparagus, so on and so forth. I want you to fill half your plate with those. And I don't care how you prepare them, because what's most important is getting them into your body in a way that you enjoy and can keep up forever. So if you hate the taste of raw vegetables. Please don't try to force yourself to eat raw vegetables. Use olive oil in that context to saute those vegetables and make them taste great, because getting the vegetables into your body is priority number one. Just please don't deep fry them. That is the only form of preparation that I would advise against. And then the next big portion of your plate, about a third of your plate, is going to be nutrient-dense proteins. And it's really important that we focus on nutrient-dense proteins, because you hear a lot of things about meat, it's good, bad, blah, blah, blah. It's just people being imprecise with language, which is unfortunate, because certainly things like Spam and hot dogs and processed meat are not good for us. Much like, for example, processed sugar, which is a plant, is not good for us. So processed anything is not good for us, whether it be meat or whether it be plants. So we want to eat nutrient-dense proteins. These are generally humanely raised animals or wild-caught seafood. Canned is fine. Frozen is fine. And having a big chunk of that on our plate because of the therapeutic impact of those nutritious sources of protein. And then the remainder of your plate can be low fructose fruits, think berries or citrus fruits. These are going to provide you the most of what you need to thrive and the least of things you don't, such as fructose or other forms of sugar, and or whole food fats, such as nuts and seeds. But what we've seen a lot of people do to make this even simpler is make half your plate non-starchy vegetables, half your plate nutrient-dense protein, and then use whole food fats and low fructose fruits for dessert. Because that's when this gets really fun, because no way of eating that is disgusting or unappetizing is a way of eating that I would recommend anyone engage in for life, because life is about being here, being present, being happy, enjoying oneself. So what's beautiful is things like coconut, cocoa, almond flour, berries, all these types of delicious decadent foods. These can make up the backbone of cakes, cookies, pies, ice creams, puddings, pretty much any baked or dessert food you can think of. We can sanitize using whole food fats and low fructose fruits. So then eating becomes so simple. It's just like pack your plate with non-starchy vegetables and nutrient-dense protein, and then eat some freaking sane dessert, and you will drop your set point and live extremely well.
Yeah, hallelujah. Now, I want to shift gears a little bit, because you got into a series where you were talking about mindset, and you got into goal setting. And you made a clear delineation about the types of goals we should be setting for ourselves. And I thought that was just brilliant. Could you take just a moment to start talking about goal setting and the types of goals we should actually be setting for ourselves?
We talk a lot about mindset in the Set Point Diet. And it's extremely important, because where your head goes, your body follows, period. I mean, how many of us have... But forget about diet, you know, we're like, I'm going to do this. And I get really excited, and the motivation wanes and it doesn't materialize over time. There is tremendous research that has taken place that can help us. Just like we know more about nutrition, we know so much. The realm of positive psychology is so powerful. And like a lot of what we've been told about nutrition is just wrong and counterproductive, a lot of what we've been told about goal setting is just wrong or counterproductive. For example, the way that we are generally told to make goals is what's called results goals. And we're generally told to do like big results goals. Let me give you an example. I want to lose 100 pounds. That's a big goal, and it is a result. 100 pounds is a result. The reason that that is bad in the scientific research, where we define bad as ineffective, meaning it's not going to yield the outcome you want, is every second... So first and foremost, you don't have ultimate control over the speed or ability to lose 100 pounds, right? There are things outside of your control that influence that. So making a goal that you have limited or no control over is not helpful, because if you can't control it, that's not helpful. But the other thing that's even more important for a lot of people that we've worked with is when you set a goal like that, you will feel like a failure every second of every day, because you haven't reached that goal and you're not even close to reaching that goal. So you've now set yourself up. Your brain is going to say, all right, 100 pounds. I got to lose. So have I lost 100 pounds yet? No, failure. How about now? No, failure. Wake up tomorrow. No, failure. So a much more empowering and effective approach to goal setting, instead of big, results goals, which are fun. They're like mental junk food, right? Oh, here's what we're going to go to a conference and I'm going to lose 100 pounds and I'm going to make $1 million and I'm going to get married and I'm going to have 5 kids. I'm going to do that all in the next 3 weeks. And for the next 12 hours, I'm going to be super excited, just like I ate a bunch of sugar, but then I'm going to crash and be like, how the hell am I actually going to do any of that? So it's like junk food for your brain. A much more sane approach is to create small process goals. So what is a process goal? A process goal is something that you do and something that you have complete control over. So a process goal of, I am going to blend a sane green smoothie, you have control over that. And it's a process. I am going to do that and it's small. I'm going to do that right now. And it's not super sexy, but what we've seen in the research, which is quite clear, is if you start stacking up process goals, if you start taking tiny actions that you can control daily, consistently, there is very little in life that will be outside of your reach. And just think about it. I mean, we know that's true, right? Small, consistent change over time is the only way anything has ever happened in any of our lives, barring winning the lottery. And we just need to recognize that and embrace that and treat the way we eat and exercise in the same way.
Well, you're going to be happy to know that I did set a sane goal. And yesterday when I went to the grocery store, I bought a lot of leafy greens and I actually made your blueberry blast smoothie yesterday. And my goal is to do that each day now.
And that's absolutely fantastic. So that's an example of what are some process goals that I can write down, I can check off, and I can do, right? I'm going to go to the grocery store and buy these ingredients, right? And that's, Alan, that's an important point, right? Because we really want to break stuff down into what is the next action. So it's one thing to be like, I'm going to make a sane smoothie. Okay. What are you going to blend it with? Crap. Don't have a blender. Don't have the ingredients. Like, we want to just back up and say, what can I, it's like, where do I start, right? This is so comp, where do I start?
Yeah.
You start where you start. Like, try to describe to me if you tried to teach someone how to walk. But like, no, explain with words how to walk. Well, you just walk, you take one foot, you pick it up, you put it in front of the other. And there's, at some point, we need to reduce stuff down to the simplest state. I am going to get in my car. I'm going to drive to Safeway. I'm going to go to aisle 3. I'm going to pick up a bag of spinach. I'm going to go to the checkout. And that seems silly, but that's how, I mean, it's like a blueprint, right? It's like code for your life. There's a reason computers work. The reason that computers work when they work is because instructions have been laid out extremely clearly, small, every step of the way. We need to do that for ourselves in our lives.
Yeah, when you're doing coding, you gotta think what's my next step? What's my next step? And this is very similar. I already had a very good blender. It's not the Vitamix that you recommend, but it's called a Ninja, but it's still a very good blender. And then I knew, okay, I need to get some more leafy greens. I need to pick up the lemons. I didn't actually use the erythritol, so that's what I did skip out on because I didn't think I'd need it with the lemon in there. And then I just, made my smoothie with some blueberries. It was awesome.
And that's a huge win because, and again, it seems like a small thing, but imagine that that became a habit. And that's another thing that we talk about in the book. So let's say that, Alan, you make that a goal and you say, look, I'm going to consciously take steps to buy these ingredients, to make these smoothies every day. And you do that for 21 days or 30 days or so on and so forth. What you're going to find is that next month, instead of it taking effort to make that smoothie, it will take effort to not make that smoothie because it will become a habit. And when you can start, when it can be easier to perform sane, healthy habits than it is to do unhealthy, insane things, that's when the magic happens. Yeah. And that absolutely can be the case. We know thousands of people within the sane family who crave green smoothies. Like they go on vacation. This happened to me and my wife. We go on vacation. We go on a cruise. We're just like, oh my gosh, I can't wait till we can get home and drink our green smoothies. We're in the midst of all this decadent, all-you-can-eat food, and we're in the habit of drinking sane smoothies. So we're just like, oh man, I love the cruise, but I hate that I can't have my green smoothies.
Yeah, the thing I'm looking at is, you know, I'm thinking, I picked up spinach and I walked past all the other stuff. And I'm like, you know, I could have put some dandelions in here. I could have, there's so much more I could have put in here that would have been interesting. So I'm looking at it as an experiment. I'm looking at it, this is going to be fun because I'm going to experiment with different fruits, different, you know, berries, different flavors, and yeah, just have some fun with it.
It is a great canvas on which to experiment in that way with optimal, what we would call optimal non-starchy vegetables. Because again, if I'm just like, hey, eat more dandelion greens, you're gonna be like, but if you can just take a handful of them, toss them in the blender with some other stuff, you can, I mean, you can toss a handful of all sorts of things into the blender. So that's just, we're not a smoothie company. This isn't called the smoothie diet, but we have found that drinking the appropriate type of sane green smoothies can be one of the simplest and most enjoyable ways to sanitize your diet and lower your set point.
Yeah, I did find, I think as 5 ounces of spinach that I put in there, because I went a little overboard. I made a whole lot, but I ate all of it or drank all of it. It would have taken me a lot of effort to eat that much in its whole food form.
100%. Yeah, I get probably 80% of the vegetables that I eat in smoothie form simply because, again, you could drink it at your desk, take it with you in the car, and that's great. You know, they're raw. They're, again, in, you don't need to use a lot of olive oil in a green smoothie, for example. So, and then you can do all sorts of fun stuff. You can use avocado to help make it more creamy so you get your whole food fats in there. It's also a great place in which to try some nutrient-dense protein. You could have some whey protein or some casein protein or some pea protein or some rice protein or some hemp protein or some pasteurized egg whites. I mean, it's a canvas on which you can really create something beautiful.
Yes. Now, you get into another concept that you call implementation intentions. And I thought those would be extremely valuable to talk about.
Implementation intentions are the natural byproduct of the process goals, the small process goals we talked about earlier, where you really start to flesh out a plan. So for example, rather than saying, I have the small goal of drinking a green smoothie tomorrow, a implementation intention will take it further and say sort of an if, when, then. So if it is the morning, when I am hungry, then I will make a sane green smoothie. So there's three components to it, and it's almost like making the decision ahead of time. And this is really important because I don't think we talk about this in the book, but you can be in what's called a hot state or a cool state. And this, not to digress too much, but you know, if you've ever found yourself in a context of passion with another human being, right? It's one thing, like if you get cut off in traffic to say, what, calmly on my couch, I will behave this way. But when someone cuts you off in traffic or, you know, jeopardizes the life of your family members in your car, you become emotionally aroused and your decision-making process changes a bit, right? Implementation intentions help you to act out and create an entire game plan for how you're going to react and act, I should say act, not react, in certain situations before those happen. So when I get from, if I get home from work and I am stressed out and I open the refrigerator, then I will grab the container of a pre-cut or, you know, pre-washed sugar snap peas and I will binge on those. Like, you literally have a plan for situations where you find yourself making insane choices. You have yourself set up, you have a game plan in place, you get that written down in a very simple formulaic way, and you are now empowered because you have made the decision and created the plan before you need to, so that when you need to, you're ready.
Yeah. It used to be at the office, they would bring these donuts, and they're called spud nuts, and they're literally made out of potato flour. So probably the most insane food on earth, because they're coated in sugar and they're potato flour. And when they bring them in the office, it's like watching sharks be chummed. You know, it's like they're all over the break room. So I just had this strategy, which was a similar, it was like this intentions, where I'd go in and say, if they've brought spud nuts, I'm going into my office and I'm going to eat a bag of nuts and I'm going to stay out of the break room until lunchtime.
And the reason, Alan, that is so powerful is contrast that with just even the small, like the goal of, I'm not going to eat spud nuts. Like that is a small goal, and it is, I mean, that's actually more of like a result, the result of I'm not going to eat them, but how? Like that doesn't, yeah. How am I going to not eat spud nuts, right? These goals without hows are meaningless. And especially when you ask the question of how, the whole like, I'm going to lose 100 pounds, well, how?
Yeah.
And that it quickly falls down. So implementation intentions force that how in an elegant way.
Absolutely. Now you get into something else in the mindset part of the book that I just love, because I think it's an underutilized aspect to wellness. And that is the concept of gratitude.
Gratitude is one of those things which research has just shown without a shadow of a doubt that to not leverage gratitude is to your psychology like not eating vegetables is to your biology. There's basically a dose-dependent relationship in the amount of gratitude that you proactively seek to express and your mood. So gratitude journaling, consciously setting aside time to once a day tell people you love, hey, I appreciate how you emptied the dishwasher today. Hey, I appreciate how you noticed my new socks. It sounds simple, but so does eat your vegetables. And sometimes the most profound changes in life come from the simplest practices in life. And gratitude is one of those.
Yeah. I for the longest time struggled with stress. I've been fortunate. I was actually fortunate to get laid off. And now actually I've had a year of what I would call healing so that I can make 2019 kind of my complete whoosh of trying to get as de-stressed as possible. But one of my kind of my eye-opening moments was when I came to the realization that when you're experiencing joy, you don't feel stress. And to me, gratitude is one of those self-inflicted joys. You know, when you start actually thinking about how good things are, even the little things, it's actually like you've taken in a bit of joy, self-induced joy in that moment. And it's just a complete de-stressor.
That's been my experience as well, Alan. And I will give the listeners to this an advanced technique that is actually not in the book simply because we were so over the word count. It was supposed to be 80,000 words. We already went so over. We had to start cutting some stuff. But some people hear gratitude and they're like, okay, what? So there's a different way to approach gratitude that I've found to be helpful for some people, which is while it may not feel great, like let's say you have a cat that you really like, and you're just like, I like my cat. I like my cat. I like my cat. This isn't doing anything for me. Why did I listen to that podcast? There's a different approach, and this sounds a little bit morbid, but it has a long track record historically. It's just not talked about a lot. And imagine that something happened to your cat as deeply as possible. And not for a long time, but just like take 60 seconds and literally play through in your mind that something bad happened and you no longer had your cat. Then stop and hug your cat. And you will instantly feel more grateful for your cat than you did before. So there's two approaches. For some people, just based on their personality type, being like, hey, Snookums, I love you. I'm so grateful for you. That works. And if that works, please do it. For other personality types, that does not work. And all you need to do is close your eyes and imagine if Snookums wasn't around graphically. Then open your eyes and hug Snookums. In either case, you're going to get that sense of joy that is so helpful with stress.
Absolutely. Now, I define wellness as being the healthiest, fittest, and happiest you can be. What are three strategies or tactics to get and stay well?
Drink sane green smoothies every day. Sleep at least 7 hours and prioritize your life so that you can do that. Love and contribute as deeply as possible.
Those are wonderful. I adore those. Thank you for sharing that. Now, Jonathan, if someone wanted to get in touch with you, learn more about the Set Point Diet and the things you're doing, where would you like for me to send them?
Please go to our website, which is Sane Solution. That's Sane Solution, singular.com. And that will give you all the information on the book, a bunch of free resources, wonderful mini series coming out, tremendous coaching programs, all sorts of good stuff, sanesolution.com.
Awesome. You can go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/363, and I'll be sure to have all the links there. So Jonathan, thank you so much for being a part of the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Alan.
I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I enjoyed having that conversation. Some really good information for you to take into your January. I am very happy to say that I have finally received copies of the Wellness Roadmap so that I can do some signed copies. If you would like a signed copy of the book, all you have to do is go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/hardbound if you want the hardbound version, or 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/paperback if you want the paperback edition. So that's, again, that's 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/hardbound or 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/paperback. I can only do this during the month of January because, as you know, in February, I am moving to Panama. So if you want a signed copy of the book, this is your opportunity. 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/hardbound or 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/paperback. Also, I wanted to let you know that I have partnered with a lab company called MyLabWork.com, and they are really, really cool company in that they offer discounted lab work, and you get to pick the lab work that you want done. So this is something that they have the doctor there. They go ahead and call it in or send it in. You just show up at one of the Quest centers. It's already prepaid by them. So you just pay them. Then they take care of all the back end work. They do these wonderful reports. They give you all kinds of information. And I'm going through their educational course right now. So I'm also in a pretty good position to help you kind of understand what is going on with those. So maybe we can do a Q&A if some of you are out there doing your lab work and want to kind of talk about what some of these numbers mean. But you can go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/lab. They offer really good discounts. The rates they're charging for these lab tests are really, really cost effective if you want to get things done, whether it be your hormones, your cholesterol, or any other kind of panel that you want to check out. They've got a multitude of items for you to choose from, and you can pick and choose the specific tests that you're interested in. I did the full workup. So, I mean, I have a complete, you know, particle count on my cholesterol. I have all the hormone checks, all that stuff done. Now, I do that in my wellness trips with my doctor, but this was even deeper than what my doctor orders. So this was really, really good information for me to have going into the new year because I can use that now as a basis for how well my activities and the things that I'm doing for myself are in fact improving my health. And you know, I'm not a big fan of the scale. These numbers that you're going to get from your blood labs are going to be so much more important as a measure and metric of health. So you can go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/lab, and that'll take you to their site. It's a really, like I said, really cool service that they're doing. 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/lab. Thank you. Next time on the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we meet Erin Boardman-Walthen and discuss her book, Why Can't I Stick to My Diet? Until then, have a happy and healthy week.